Dear guests, dear members of staff, dear students, ladies and gentlemen, the current academic year saw the development of a French society at the LSE. Starting from zero, the Friends of France have become one of the most active societies on campus. I would like to thank our guests that they were willing to come here and to speak on the French paradox and British liberalism. And before I pass the word on to Professor Professor Marston has kindly agreed to chair this event. Before I pass the word on, let me remind you to please switch your mobiles off. So now, please give a warm welcome to our guests.
Well, it is a very great honor today for us to have our two speakers, Monsieur Olivier Fleurot, who is Managing Director of the Financial Times newspaper, and Monsieur Pascal Boris, who is Chief Executive Officer of BNP Paribas, a big French bank, which is increasingly an international bank and perhaps less and less French. But both of our speakers today represent the French paradox, I think, very thoroughly, at least the modern French paradox. Both were educated in the elite institutions in France, at the École Nationale Supérieure des Mines at Saint-Étienne, and you are also Chevalier de la Légion d'Honneur, which is the nearest the French come to a monarchic tradition of knighthood that we have in England.
Invented by Napoleon.
Invented by Napoleon. Well, he was an emperor, wasn't he? And you were from the École des Hautes Études Commerciales in Paris, but you've also studied at New York and in London. So both of our speakers know the French system extremely well, would perhaps normally have been part of the French elite along with Monsieur Jospin, Monsieur Chirac, and the people who stayed behind in Paris. But they are greatly international, as you can see from the work from Monsieur Fleurot's work at the Financial Times, and before then at the Financial Times Deutschland and at Les Echos, and your own work, Monsieur Boris, at Chase Manhattan and in Switzerland. So both our speakers are very well qualified to speak about the French paradox, but I think also from the time they've spent in England, they're very well qualified to talk about the British paradox, which we call neoliberalism. Without saying any more, I'm going to ask both if they would speak for about 10 minutes to introduce their ideas, and then we shall throw the floor open to questions and debate, and we shall see how things go from there. Thank you very much. So, Monsieur Fleurot, we agreed would speak first.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much, and thank you to the Friends of France for inviting me to take part in the discussion panel. So the question is about the French paradox, and the first thing I would say is that on the face of it, probably France has been doing rather well recently. Inflation has been very low over the last 10 years, well below 2% since 1992. The other impressive factor is that the GDP growth has been one of the highest in Europe over the last 5 years until the end of last year. French GDP has grown at a consistently higher rate than German GDP, for instance, which shows a dramatic change over previous economic cycles. Although unemployment has fallen, the unemployment rate is still much too high in France and rising again, unfortunately, above 9%. And total debt has reached what I would call dangerous levels, and it appears that that's something we can discuss, that the state occupies too large a territory in France. So what's happening exactly in the country of engineers huge state programs and heavy investment in infrastructure like railways or high-speed train or nuclear power stations. Are the high tax levels and labor rigidity such handicaps that France is destined to lose its competitive edge? Well, we have always used Germany as a benchmark, and I would first suggest that it's probably time to change if we don't want to see other European countries making faster progress than us. And maybe the UK is now a more interesting point of comparison. So France is a country where 45% of GDP is sort of redistributed or managed by the states or its administrations through what we call prélèvement obligatoire, literally mandatory deductions, which are the total tax burden on individuals and companies. The total public spend by the state, directly or indirectly, and by regional authorities, amounts to about 50% of GDP. And let's not forget that although we've had a very a consistent privatization process in France, the state, the French state, still owns a majority stake in France Telecom and a 100% stake in EDF and SNCF, the railway, to mention the most notable examples of how a state can still intervene in very competitive markets. So it's quite different from the UK situation. Just imagine that Vodafone, for instance, still belonged to the state. Civil servants represent 20% of the total working population. Canada and Ireland, which used to be in a similar situation, have now joined ranks with Germany, Spain, and the USA, a group of countries where the proportion of civil servants represents 15% of the total population. As you know, countries tend to evaluate their competitiveness by looking at how well they can attract foreign investment. While judging on these criteria, you could say that France is doing fairly well. But if you look at the real nature of the investment, you'll see that it has nothing or little to do with capital investment in new production facilities. Most foreign investment is made up of acquisition of assets. There is an apparent contradiction between the fact that total household consumption regularly increased between 1997 and 2001, it's about 50% of French GDP, and the fact that French people save a lot. The rate of savings at an average of 16% in France is much higher than in the UK. Does this show a lack of economic confidence on the part of the French? Maybe this cautious approach comes from the very low rate of activity. 30% of the population is unemployed. This is not the figure you usually see. We usually say we have 9% or 10% unemployment rate. But it means that people who could be working today, for instance, if you take people in the age range of 55 to 64, well, only 2 in 5 men work and only 1 in 3 women work. So the activity of the total population who could work is quite low. And this low employment ratio can in turn be explained by one of the great weaknesses of the French economy, I think, the traditionally low level of capital investment by French companies. Between 1990 and 1998, for instance, capital expenditure by French companies in France was basically flat, while it was increasing by 12% in the Eurozone and literally booming in the US. I think the increase there was over 60%. It is a controversial issue in France. French CEOs are saying that the reason for this low investment in France is due to the poor fiscal, legal, and social environment created there. Certainly the 35-hour week imposed on all companies, regardless of size and sector, didn't reassure them. The fact is that in 2000, French production capacity, probably limited the output. In other words, because of a long period of underinvestment, France was struggling to take advantage of the good years, which is a pity. By contrast, the UK situation is one of low unemployment, stable growth, and controlled inflation. As Sir Eddie George said in an interview in a Pink newspaper, which I can't mention, if you ask me what's the thing that gives me the most pleasure, it is that unemployment is as low as it's been for 25 years. I think that's what it's really all about, talking about his policy at the helm of the Bank of England. So is the UK now a much more attractive place for foreign investors? According to a ranking compiled by the Economist Intelligence Unit, during the 1996 and 2000 period of direct investments per head in France was only half what the UK received, and a quarter of direct investment in Holland, for instance. And in this respect, other countries like Poland, Czech Republic and Hungary are catching up with France. In other words, they attract more foreign investment than we do per head. Other indicators tell a different story. You could, you know, a lot of people say, but in the last 10 years, France has improved a lot. Its competitiveness is much higher. We've had huge productivity gains, quality of life, quality of public services. For instance, it is true that the health system is probably one of the best in the world, and public transport is also quite good. Well-educated employees mean that France is a very attractive place to work and live. Well, you could easily say, in fact, that in terms of public services, France has a distinct advantage over the UK. So maybe what we really need to do is to make a big improvement to our situation, is to maintain the quality of public services while improving their efficiency. There is a unique opportunity here. About half of French civil servants will retire within the next 10 years. So by only replacing maybe two out of three of them, we could quickly increase productivity and reduce taxes. Two other key programs must also, I think, be implemented. We have a need for a dramatic reform of our pension systems. Pensioners nowadays receive a healthy pension, but their purchasing power will drastically fall within the next 15 years unless we completely overhaul the system. And two, I think we need to, a transformation of all state aids in order to ensure that there is a much greater incentive for unemployed people to find a job and a greater flexibility of social laws. So is that what Mr. Raffarin, the new Prime Minister, wants to do? Well, until we know more about his goals and his achievements, France will probably be regarded by foreign investors as a strange country where, to their surprise, companies are still successful in spite of all its obvious constraints and rigidities. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me? Thank you, first of all, to the Friends of France for inviting me to participate to this panel. And thank you also to Professor Marsden for his kind words of introduction. I mean, Olivier said so many things that I'm going to try to not say exactly the same, even though I think the facts are the same and the conclusion generally will be the same. It's maybe a different steer on things. In business, we need to constantly look at our competitive position, benchmarking, unique selling points, providing value. Now, should countries do the same? And looking at those criteria, is France competitive? Benchmarking, as pointed out earlier by Olivier, France traditionally benchmarked itself against Germany with the same tradition of continental social democracy and a deal between state, business, and unions. Now, people would have us benchmark ourselves against the UK, as Olivier has just proposed. But should one have a fixed benchmark, or should one look at benchmarking a country against best practices? For instance, Holland. Holland has a very strong tradition, as well as Germany and France, of social cohesion, of redistribution. And yet, Holland has managed to introduce flexibility in its labor practices to the point that unemployment has fallen dramatically. Holland had the same level of unemployment than France had 10 years ago. It has introduced laws about part-time work, about the amounts of taxes that on labor that need to be paid by employers, such that, and has introduced incentives for people to find jobs, such that now Holland has one of the lowest unemployment rates in Europe, and yet has maintained its tradition. So really the question is, if we're going to benchmark ourselves, should we try to benchmark, and that's true actually for the UK, it's true for any country, should countries try to benchmark themselves against what is viewed as the best practices? Again, that goes back to also what is the social contract between the government and the people. What is the purpose of government? Is it trying to, you know, what is, it opens up the question of why is government in power and what are they trying to achieve and what is the nature of the contract that governments have with their electorate. But we're not going to open that debate yet. Unique selling points. I mean, what are the unique selling points of France? Well, geography is one of them. I mean, it is at the crossroads of many trade flows. When you look at, if you did a chart of the GDP and of the population, the center of production of GDP in Europe and of population in Europe, France is probably uniquely located at the center of that. So therefore, that is a benefit, and it's for France to take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. France also has a few quality infrastructure. At what price is the question? An educated labor force, one of the best health systems in the world, as Olivier has pointed out earlier, and it's a very productive country for those who work. Now, the question is, you know, there's not enough people working, and there are a lot of people who are not in work who are enjoying the benefits of the works from others. And then the next question is value for money. Is the state efficient? Is the state efficient as a redistributor of 45% of the GDP? Are the resources channeled towards achieving sustainable growth for the country? Really, the state is, that's the tradition of the post-World War II and beverage in the UK, of the state being a big machine of redistribution of welfare, but literally amongst the middle class. I mean, it goes from the middle class to the middle class through different ages. I mean, you give money to people at school, and you give money to people in retirement, but it's really all the middle class. It's a big machine of redistribution. It is not really providing a safety net. Should that be the role of the state, of being there to provide a safety net and let other people take care of their own needs through various systems of either pension, it's private pension funds, it's opened up the debate about private pension funds in France and indeed in other countries on the continent. And also the question of means testing. Should everybody be entitled to receiving what is known in France as the allocation familiale? When you have children, you receive a certain amount of money, whatever your resources, because you have children. And is that really, and there's a big machine to administer this, is that an efficient use of resources? Is that an efficient way of using taxes? Then is the state efficient as an investor? Clearly, during the year of reconstruction, the state, with the planning, the five-year plans, has had some notable successes. But one could argue that, you know, those successes would have happened no matter what, because there was growth, because of the pent-up demand for everything. And so, you know, whether the state channeled the resources toward those industry or whether those private capital would have channeled those resources to meet the needs of the people is an open question. It is true that in building up, rebuilding the infrastructure, the state has been an efficient allocator of resources. And certainly two generations later, people enjoy the fruits of the investments at the time that the state has made or has channeled towards trains, dams, the nuclear power plants, whether, you know, from an ecology point of view, people think it's a good idea or not. It is true that electricity in France, electricity prices are the lowest in Europe as a result, in particular, of nuclear energy. So during the reconstruction years, France, the state, has been a generally successful allocator of resources towards infrastructure. The world has changed. There's less needs for nuclear power plants, there's less needs for new lines, trains, or motorways. So it begs the question as to whether, as an investor, you still need the same role of the state. And there are also not areas in which the state has been a dismal failure, such as in the Bull, the computer company. It started with the Plan Calcul, so that France was independent of the U.S. in terms of supercomputers for the purpose of building the atomic bomb, and General de Gaulle felt that he could not rely on the Americans to provide those computers. So therefore, as part of that program, the Plan Calcul was introduced, which resulted in Bull. And since then, it's been the long death of Bull, which in the end will probably go the way ICL has gone in the UK, which was to be acquired by, the ICL has been acquired by Fujitsu.
That's right.
And the only users of Bull equipment are local authorities and the civil service. Anyway, as an employer, is the state efficient? Well, first of all, it can't tell how many people it employs. If you ask people how many fonctionnaires are there, they don't know. There is no flexibility for transfers. So if you work in a ministry or in a certain administration and there are no needs for you, and there are requirements in another part of the administration, you can't transfer from one to the next because there are separate status and separate seniority plans, et cetera, et cetera. And it is an easy, it's easy to blackmail, because if you go against the state and you can, the state, you know, just ahead of the elections, if you have functionaries go on strike and demonstrate, the state will immediately give up because the last thing it wants is riot in the streets and problems and headlines. So it is very easy to blackmail somebody who really has no power. It's so powerful that it has really no power. And then there's the issue as an employer. The state hasn't funded its pension plans because it feels that it can always raise taxes to do so. So as an employer, it is doing things that private employers would not be allowed to do, not to mention the fact that it has dismally failed to introduce the 35-hour week. And I'm not going to open the debate as to whether that means increasing the number of hours people work or reducing them in the fonctionnaire, but suffice it to say, it has not been able to introduce the 35-hour week in the civil service. As a producer, it is still measuring what it does in terms of quantity, not quality. Its quantity for instance, in the national education system, its quantity of degrees, 80% must have the baccalaureate. It's quantity of everything. It's never quality. It's never quality of service. And should the state be, rather than a producer, become a service provider? And a service provider in the next stage being really setting up the guideline as to what services should be provided, and then determining whether it should be the public or the private sector that provides those services. It's a bit like deciding, you know, what is the national curriculum for education, and then letting perhaps private enterprise or public services run schools in different areas, in some of the more deprived areas. You know, should it be the private sector? Should it be the public sector? Can they provide special incentives for teachers to work into deprived areas? The state is not responsive to the ever-changing needs, and let's not forget that the people have moved from being employees and workers to being consumers. I mean, the state has had a great role as protecting the producers and the employees, and today the demand for most people is to be protected as consumers of services, consumers of products, consumers of the state. People are not so worried about being protected as producers. I think there's a big shift, and I think the same happens in the UK, and the politics in the UK have changed to reflect this. Certainly new labor is more geared towards looking after the needs of the consumers than it is after looking at the needs of the producers. So I think that concludes my few remarks. And as Sir Martin has suggested, now we open the floor For questions?
Thank you very much. I'm sure there are lots of questions. We have a roving microphone, so if you could let me know, then I'll indicate who the microphone should go to.
It's always the first question that's the most difficult one.
At the back.
Sorry, after the election of Mr. President Chirac, or re-election, there's been talk of the elite who are running France would continue doing so in the same fashion. Do you see the outcome of that election as changing things at all from a business perspective?
Well, as you know, the in 5 weeks we'll have parliamentary elections and legislative elections. At the moment, there are signs that in the new government they've asked Francis Maire, who was the president of a big company in the steel industry, to be in charge of the finance and economy ministry. This is a very interesting move. I don't know if it's going to work, but because you could say that he's not completely part of the elite, but he's not either somebody who is completely out of that close or foreign to that very close circle of quite high-profile people. But he has certainly a very, very good knowledge of the industry and companies and how to manage companies. But his task is huge. We were talking about that just before starting. And the Ministry of Finance is a bastion of very, very strong unions. And a few ministers have tried to reform it and have failed. So we'll see. But really, we have to wait. We have to wait for the result of the elections. If they don't give a clear majority to the centre right or right, then we'll be in a more difficult position, I think.
I think there's a general question about what is the role of the elite in France and how much it is easy or not for people who are not part of the elite to run, to do anything in France. I think it's one of the issues about the education system in France. It's a wonderful education system. But on the other hand, if you fail 1 year and you don't have the right mark at the baccalaureate, you may not be able to enter the right school. And so everything is decided very early on and you have very few opportunities later on in life. I mean, you can have a successful career as a businessman even if you haven't been through enough. It's actually probably a prerequisite. But most of the time, unlike in the US where people can do what they want, or in the UK where people take a gap year and read literature at LSE, for instance. Can you read literature at LSE? No, probably not.
Economic literature,
right, or I'm a classicist. And they can, I have lots of my people work in the bank. I have a guy who, first of all, you don't look at what they did. You look at what school they went through. You look at what they've done recently when you hire them. They come from the right firm, they have the right business, and you sort of look at the CV, but as a sort of second thing. In France, you first look at the CV and what, you even see that in people's death notice when they're 90 years of age. It says ancien de l'école polytechnique. Which you would never think of seeing here. So you've got this thing in France that it predetermines what you do. Here you have people, so again, I have people who read history at Oxford and one of the best bankers we have. It's hard to think of anybody with a degree in history who is a successful banker in France. So you are predetermined very early on, and I think that creates some rigidities. It creates some excellent specialization and some very good skills at doing things, but it doesn't open up French society to being able to listen and to accept people who are different. And I think that's one of the big rigidities that France has to deal with the next generation to make it a more open and flexible society.
Did you want to come back on that, or Olivier?
Oh, I just wanted to say that probably what one of the key issues we have in terms of how the parties work and the politicians operate is that when you looked at most of the socialist ministers and the right wing ministers, they all come from the same mold and the same schools, and they are friends. You know, they were together in a university, and they probably, especially the socialists, who are supposed to represent, you know, different layers, have lost touch with the, let's say, workers, for instance.
I had dinner in early December, actually. Raffarin was there, and there were a couple of other ministers, and there was a young French MP called Nicolas Forissier, and he's a business, he owns a company, he runs a company. He told me he's only one of 10 chief executives of a business out of 577 MPs. And most of the MPs are civil servants who can go back to the civil service if they're voted out. And so you have this total linkage between the executive and the legislature, which actually doesn't, it's a bit of a rubber stamping parliament given the constitution. But still, the people, it's the same. You are a fonctionnaire, whether you are fonctionnaire in politics or fonctionnaire in the civil service, and whether in politics, whether you are in government or as an MP. So there is really a very, very, very strong tradition of the fonctionnaires running France. And they have run France very successfully for many, centuries, but certainly for quite a number of years. So it is, but the world is changing. The world is opening up. And that's why you have a lot of sympathy for people who talk about stopping mondialisation, you know, like you put some border police to make sure that the mondialisation doesn't come to France, even though France is one of the more open countries and one that has benefited most from the increase in world trade, and France has had very successful export companies. It's a bit like putting border guards in Alsace and stopping the Chernobyl fallout, the cloud. You know, it didn't stop there. Actually, you may have seen the map of the... there's a very, very strong adequacy between the shape of where the cloud, the effects of Chernobyl stopped, and where Le Pen did very well in the first round. Somebody produced that chart. I don't know. There's probably no, no correlation, but you never know. If they glow in the dark, it may be right.
Another question. Richard.
I have a question regarding Monsieur Boris's remarks about consumer and producer protection and the balance between the two. I wonder if he could talk a little about developments in regard to that balance in other countries, the US and the UK in particular, and also talk about developments within France in contrast, and perhaps how reforms might take place. Well, I realize that's a long question, so you can... take what you want from it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I'm qualified to give an answer in detail and educated an answer to all the points you have raised in your question, but I can probably share a few remarks. I think one has seen a shift. I think that's a fact in people's... Actually, when you go back to 50 years ago, the unit of geography was the village, and possibly the canton, and the people that one bowed to were the local aristocrat who may or may not still have his castle, the mayor, the instituteur, and the priest. Well, that's not happening any longer. In those days, you had few things to choose from. So what matters is whether you could have them. So you had to wait for 2 years to get the telephone lines. You could sort of go into the queue to order a car and forget about the option if a car was ever available the day you expected it, whether it was black, blue, or red, and you'd ordered that or another color, you'd take it because you needed it. So, and in those days, what mattered was producing. So naturally, the state was a producer, and it was protecting the producers, and it was protecting the workers, and you had workers' parties. And today, with the open world, first of all, the unit of geography is not the village, or it's the global village. People can have whatever they want. It's a question of, you know, which model, which option, and they don't really care whether it was manufactured in Japan. And actually, if you look at your mobile, you'll see that it may be a Finnish telephone, and you see it's been assembled in Hungary, and the battery was made in China, and it's all there inside. So what product are you buying? And the software is probably done in India. And the financing was done from London through a consortium of international banks. So, you know, you really forget what people want to know is what quality of service they get. Is it accessible at the times they want it? Does it, you know, do you have a good call center? So people have naturally become, and also people think, don't respect politicians as much as they used to because they are educated and they don't believe what the priests tell them. They don't listen to the instituteur, and they certainly don't believe the President du Conseil Général or the deputy because they know as much as he does or she does and can read it all in the newspaper, pink or otherwise.
Pink. Yeah.
Pink, yes, okay.
It's a very good color.
And so the world had changed. And so therefore, people behave as consumers. I mean, do you see yourself as a consumer in the future or as a producer? You probably see more use, but maybe you haven't asked yourself the question. You see yourself as a citizen, and a citizen who is able to exercise his or her choice, and the choices are really about consuming services, consuming government, consuming whatever. And production is a sort of, yeah, you have to produce, you have got to earn your money. But the system, the world is organized around a system whereby with free trade and increasingly open trade barriers, open economies, there'll be more consumption and people view themselves as exercising their choices as consumers. And I think that is affecting political life as well, even though it's very easy to fall back under protectionism when you see the Bush administration levying taxes on foreign steel. Why? To protect marginal seats due for re-election at the Senate in November, where Republican incumbents might lose their seats. And so protecting big steel there makes political sense. And that's why Pascal Lamy, the Frenchman who's the European Trade Commissioner, is targeting not U.S. steel companies, but companies which produce products in the U.S. in seats which are marginal for the Republicans in the next election. It's tit for tat. So this is where you have, and you haven't seen that yet for protection of consumer. You haven't seen the political measures, for instance, like this. It's more difficult to do protectionism on consumer product, other than deciding that Poitiers should be the port through which all Japanese VCR need to be clear custom, which, as you know, Poitiers is a landlocked city in France, and it's very hard for cargo ships to dock there. And that was a measure to protect. But it was done to protect not French consumer. It was done to protect French producers. So again, all the political measures, retortion measures, are, again, to protect the producers. It is very difficult, and the state, it's almost impossible to protect the consumer, the French consumer against what? The German consumer? No. You can only protect the producers who are located in your own country. And so this is what the state, goes back to form in doing, because it's already losing a lot of power through devolution, or no, it's not devolution, but it is, you know, sharing of sovereignty with Europe, and the little power it has, it tried to maintain by protecting the producer. That's the only lever it has. And I think another point perhaps to make in the EU is, in most companies, if you lose your production, you say you decide to subcontract another business, well, generally you're going to close your plant and lay off the people or transfer them to those who produce. Now, the same is not happening in France. We're talking about the Banque de France. It has, 25,000 employees? And it doesn't print the currency any longer, the notes any longer. It doesn't manage the monetary aggregates any longer. The Bank of England has 2,500 employees. So you got some of the tasks that the French central bank had to do have been, you know, farmed out to Brussels, and yet the number of staff is the same. And this is where there's a need. And also, when you look at the number of layers, for instance, of government in France, you've got the central government, you've got the regional governments through the evolution to the regions, you've got the departmental, and then the towns, 36,000 of them. Now, that's four layers before you get to the people. There are a few companies that are successful over the long haul with four layers of management before you start dealing with your clients. And I think if you add the fifth layer, which is Brussels, there's a clear need for dégraisser the country. And the mammouth is not just the French, to take the word of a minister who had kicked out for a number of reasons, including making this remark about the take the fat out of the mammoth, which was talking about the National Education Administration. But there's a lot of that to be done, and I think the point that Olivier made earlier about 50% of fonctionnaires will retire the next 10 years, that provides a unique opportunity. But the opportunity has to be tackled not just at looking at the number of fonctionnaires, but also looking at the levels of government. You don't need four layers of government in France. You don't need the department any longer, probably. The department was originated, I think, by Napoleon also, and the idea was that from the chef-lieu of the department, you could travel to the outer limits of the department by horse in one day. And that's how the limits were created. Now, today, you don't, you know, I'm not sure the horse is the what you need. And but it's interesting.
It'd be stored by car, I should think.
It'd be stored by car, yes, that's right. And by train, because they'd be on strike. But so anyway, I don't know whether that answers your question or not. But that's
if I just can add something, but I think the need for protection will and is shifting very quickly now from the production and the side to the consumer side, and I think we've had a few cases already of the BSE and problems like that. That consumers will ask governments or other institutions to protect them against that kind of health problems, food problems, and they are much more difficult to deal with. But there will, I think, the biggest scandals will happen in this field in the future, because there is no way governments can really now deal with production, because production is worldwide, and so yeah, I see a clear shift in what governments and states have to do, and we see more and more. Actually, you see a shift, a creation of what we call regulators, people who are supposed to regulate this field. This field, we want to create a European, what is it, food agency or health and food agency to try to protect consumers.
Follow that question, and really, do you think, from your knowledge of the neoliberal Britain, as taken today's title, that the neoliberal state is better at looking after the consumer rather than the producer than the traditional French state? Do you think there are lessons that you can learn from Britain? Maybe you don't want to criticize Britain while you're in Britain, but imagine you're in Paris. What would you be? What lessons would you draw from your knowledge of London and Britain?
First of all, I would say that, you know, it's horses for courses. I think the each country has the government it wishes, and which is based on its tradition. And I think there's a more Protestant ethics in the running of the country for centuries and centuries, where people have to look after themselves. And so it was, other than the interval, it was beverage after World War II for 50 years. I think there's more a tradition in the UK and indeed in the US. as almost a subsidiary company that spun off some years ago, more liberal policies and of an acknowledgement that there can be inequality, that inequality is probably the engine of the economy. I think that tradition is different in the in France, and I think the system works for Britain. Whether you could import the British system into France and the French system into the UK, I'm not sure. I think again, it's a question of looking at what should the objectives be, and the objectives are also based on who you are dealing with, and you don't deal with the French or the Germans or the British in the same way. So I'm trying to really duck out of your question.
If you had to choose between the two, there's another question, so perhaps.
I'm sorry, I really didn't answer your question. Maybe you want to do that, or you're quite a...
Is neoliberalism better at looking after the consumer than the producer?
Well, no, by definition, I would say liberalism is you know, doesn't pay as much attention to consumers, because you know it's a more open competition in a way, but it does not mean that the type of problems we mention are like BSC or other problems like that are. Look at the way we try to deal with them in France as well as it just happened that it started here, maybe because of a lack of regulation, by the way, if I understand well what happened exactly, which at the beginning was the fact that producers of food for, you know,
feedstock
were allowed not to sort of sterilize that. So it was a lack of regulation which apparently started the problem. But we had problems in France with contaminated blood, and these problems are really tough to deal with.
But I think if you don't have regulations, or you don't have regulations, what you'll have is lawyers. And you look at the U.S., where you have little regulations, you go for the lawyers, and you go for a bit more uncertainty as a result, and you got protection. You know, if you have a bottle of champagne, it tells you not to be careful that the cork may pop out, and I mean, you got health warnings and everything, and people lose common sense. You may have the impression that we've described France as being a place of a backwards place, still in the ages of darkness.
That's not the impression I have.
But anyway, to dispel that impression, in case anybody had it, there's a lot of, you know, you could argue that there's always a flip side to anything what we say. France have been burdened by regulation. As a result, the companies still have to, you know, still are. You have very profitable companies, and when they go overseas, they are very talented at dealing with. It's like if you are training with a 50-pound bag on your, and you're trying to run, and all of a sudden they tell you, okay, now you only have to carry 20 pounds. You're very efficient. And so there is that element. There's another element, which is within the French civil service, you've got many people who understand that things need to change. I mean, you have, you know, people are very open. They are aware of what's happening outside, and they are trying, and people are trying. So I think there is a generation of people who have trained overseas, who have worked overseas among the fonctionnaires, and I think you will see France will react. I think France have fallen back a bit in terms of GDP per head in the past 20 years, and I think people are fully aware of this, and I think the country is probably ripe now for some reforms, and we'll see in 5 weeks' time whether there is a at the general election, whether the chamber is of the same U, not Monsieur U, the same U than that of Jacques Chirac, and I think then there will be some long overdue reforms in France, and people are much more ready than what people think. There is a very, very strong group of in the media, in the few union leaders, who you know, will, to the bitter end, try to confiscate flexibility from the economy. I mean, I'm thinking of the Ministry of Finance, unions who will refuse every change. But when the winds will change, that generation will go where they are ready to retire, and there are also a lot of union leaders such as Madame Nota who is willing to move, and a lot of, so people tend to say, okay, all the unions are bad, all the fonctionnaires are bad, nothing will ever change in France. And I think the time when people say that, and they say it very loud, is probably the time that things are ready to change. So I think I'm generally optimistic that things will evolve in France.
Could we just perhaps take two last questions, and then last speakers will have a chance to comment on that. There's one in the middle here, I think, and one at the back.
So far it seems to me you've been saying two things, one quite explicitly and the other more implicitly. And I mean, explicitly, basically what you've been saying is that in France there's this conflict between the interest, like all these vested interests of the civil service, the workers and everything, and the interests of business. And you're also saying, of course, that the interests of business should be heeded more closely. And that's one thing. But then sort of implicitly you also seem to be going beyond that, namely that in a sense business should also have a bigger voice. I mean, you were mentioning whatever the sort of the members of parliament who are also entrepreneurs and whatever, also foreign direct investment should be a bigger indicator. We should pay more attention to that. And I just want to ask in a sense, I mean, well, what that basically means is that that as a business or as business people, you have you've become more political in a sense. And also, I mean, the situation here strikes me as quite unusual in a sense that we have business people who are who have a lot to say about politics and who are listening to as politics. So what I want to know is how do you personally think of yourselves as political beings in a sense? Like traditionally as citizens we think, okay, our means of expression are voting, for instance. But as you said, I mean, the sort of the nation state has less of political scope in a sense now, and our power has gone to people like you and should also go there. So how do you think of yourselves when, in terms of what political steps do you take or activities?
So business and politics, there's one question at the back, if we can take both questions, and then our two speakers can say a few words in reply.
This is addressed to both either Monsieur Ferro or Monsieur Boris. It returns to the first question. What specific action would you suggest to address the issue of what you see as rigidity in French society? Thank you.
What action on rigidity to reduce the rigidity in French society? Okay, thank you. Monsieur Fleurot, would you like to?
Well, I think on the last question, rigidity. Again, you know, I think it's and it links with the previous one. The issue is how much risk are you prepared to accept as an individual in the way you you work, in the way you move inside that environment. There are dangers, there are risks. You know that in the U.S., if you start a company and you fail, and well, people say, you know, good experience for you, and you can start another one and fail. And there's a guy who, at the end, after he's failed 10 times, has written a book and has made a huge success about the book. With the book, you know, How I Failed 10 Times and the Lessons You Can Learn About That. It's a very different attitude, you know. And in France, people would, probably don't accept the same level. So it would be quite easy to lower the level of constraints and rigidities by just allowing people to move more, mobility, you know, between status. Today, if you are a civil servant, it's very you have very specific terms and conditions in a way. Your pension might be a very special too, and so that doesn't encourage you to move into a different environment, and vice versa. So to answer the other question, the risk is that you have two silos, two fronts. One is, you know, in a very protected environment, with everything is guaranteed for life, because that's what it is, and the other part trying to work in a very different with different rules in a way. We should try to avoid that, and we should make sure that there are more possibilities for people to move from one bastion to the to the other one, like maybe in the US, and certainly more here in the UK. People move and between these two worlds in a way.
I think on rigidity, I think I think I said in my earlier the answer to the previous question. I think France looks rigid, but all the elements for some changes are here. And I think there is an image of rigidity, and yet there's a lot of flexibility. I mean, France is still a very strong exporter. It is still a company. Companies are able to continue to make profits even in France in spite of all the social law. You have labor laws that provide for protection for the permanent employees, so there's been a huge surge in temporary employment. So there are elements of flexibility, and you have always a big difference between what is stated and what is really happening. And people, have a political platform that will say things which pander to the electorate, and yet when they're in government, they might do things a bit differently. We'll still keep talking about the refusal to, for instance, have an impôt négatif, which was one of the measures proposed by the Liberals to get people out of the unemployment trap, that if you start work, you lose so many benefits that it's not worth your while looking for a job. But the word impôt négatif was not accepted because it came from the Liberals. So you had social government keep saying, we're not going to do impôt négatif, but we're going to introduce a prime pour l'emploi, which essentially was a different word for exactly the same mechanism. So you have that in France, and you have to be able to decipher between what is being said and what is really happening. Now, answering your question in terms of, do we see ourselves as business people doing politics? Frankly, my comments were more about a citizen. I mean, do you see yourself as a student or as a citizen, and what's your view of the world? I mean, the views you will express are your views as you see, and it turns out that today you're a student, tomorrow you'll be, a journalist, an academic, a successful businessman. But the views that you are a consumer of policies and of politics, and you can be a producer of them. And this is really being, able to exercise your rights as a citizen and participate into the debate. And of course, you will provide a view that will be colored by your experience. And the comment I was making about Nicolas Forissier, one of the 10 MPs who is a business people, is just to say that the French Parliament was probably not representative of France. It was representative of a certain part of France, which is the one that Olivier has just described, being in this very cosseted silo where everything's guaranteed. So you can't count on those people to introduce change. Why would they?
Well, thank you very much indeed. I think that the answer to the paradox of France and the neoliberalism in Britain was perhaps put by a colleague of mine who spoke about flexible rigidities in one case and rigid flexibilities in the other. And it may be that in between those there's more similarity and more scope to do this benchmarking that you were talking about earlier on than one might think. I'd like to thank both of our speakers very much for coming along, and also the side effects.